Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court this morning has one matter on its oral submission docket. That is an original mandamus proceeding, Jeff Wentworth versus Fred Meyer, Chairman, State Republican Executive Committee. The court will allow relator and respondents each 25 minutes to present oral argument. Relator may reserve a portion of this time for a rebuttal argument. The court is now ready to hear argument from relator.
May I please
report,
Mr. Buck Wood and Mr. Charles Clark,
May it please the court, my name is Buck Wood. I'm counsel for the relator. During the many years, I can now say that, and I've got a little gray hair, that I've appeared before the courts of this state, before this court, in many instances on behalf of clients who are public officials or candidates for public office. This case, of all those cases, stands out. I can't ever say that I have felt more strongly about a case of this nature during all the times that I've appeared in candidate eligibility cases. This case not only affects relator Jeb Wentworth, it affects hundreds, if not thousands, of potential candidates every 2 years who wish to run for the legislature. This is occurring, admittedly, by all parties, to a great extent by accident. These hundreds of people, otherwise qualified, people that we would all agree ought to be eligible to run for the legislature, are being disqualified on a true technicality, one which neither the framers of our Constitution nor the framers of recent legislation ever intended. I think our Constitution, as interpreted by this court, should be construed to carry out the basic fundamental fairness that our people of this state demand. The construction that is being placed on provisions of the Constitution that are involved here, Article 3, Section 19, are disqualifying hundreds, and every few years, thousands of otherwise eminently qualified people to run for the legislature. The relator would ask this court to construe the Constitution, applying the age-old rule that what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Counsel, what, in your opinion, is the purpose of Section 19?
Article 3, Section 19, I think, as this court has noted in the past, has its roots in medieval England, where the king sought to influence Parliament by having his appointees run for Parliament. And at that point in time, the king's appointees were very powerful because they had lucrative offices. That's where the whole concept, and they had money, they had power, and they had position. And therefore, they had the ability to get themselves elected to Parliament. In effect, the king was attempting to subvert Parliament to some extent, at least have representation of Parliament. That is the only rationale that I can see for Article 3, Section 19. The United States Supreme Court, in Clements v. Fashion, I think, basically struggled and found some state purpose in Article 3, Section 19 by saying that it prevented what I call term jumping, people running midterm, jumping from one office to the other. And I believe that while the United States Supreme Court, by the way, I was a lawyer in that case and I was never so shocked when we lost it, but I believe the United States Supreme Court, in a plurality opinion, it was a 5-4 opinion with the concurrence, would never have upheld the application of Article 3, Section 19 that this court is being presented with today. had they been presented with a situation for the legislature not so many years ago in an admirable attempt to prevent midnight gubernatorial appointments, moved terms, in this case, 21-day move. The term of this office would have expired on January the 10th, normally, until with Senate Bill 194, the terms were all moved to February 1. So the term of the office that was held by Relator Wentworth on the Board of Regents of the Texas State University System was moved from January 10th to February 1, a legislative move that I think most people applauded. We've had a problem for years and years between both mostly Democratic governors, but certainly some Republican governors, about late-term appointments. That changed all that, eliminated the problem. It was done for no other purpose but that. You have before you affidavits of the legislators that were involved. The Democratic Party has taken the position in this case that never was that legislation intended to disqualify hundreds of people every 2 years for office. But the overlap that we're talking about here is 20 days, 19 days. Now, I said a while ago that I think this court should apply sauce for the goose and apply it also for the gander. The legislature, when faced with this identical type of problem in 1968, when the Supreme Court, after Spears v. Davis, strongly indicated that they thought there might be a problem with the January 1 to when the legislature finally was sworn in, whatever day that would be, it could be as late as the 12th or the 13th at that time, the legislature immediately passed a proposed constitutional amendment which protected them from being held ineligible to run for other offices like Attorney General, or Controller, or Railroad Commission. They said specifically that the short-term overlap between January 1 and whenever they would take office would be de minimis. And for the first time, and in the only instance that I'm familiar with, the concept of de minimis is placed in our Constitution in respect to short-term overlaps. That decision has been made that those short-term overlaps are de minimis. They are not only not in violation of a state purpose, they are in furtherance of a state purpose. The people adopted that Constitution.
Doesn't the absence of that language from the provision at issue here mean something?
Your Honor, had we taken up Article 3, Section 19 at the same time that the legislature took up to protect their eligibility to run, I would say yes. However, no action was taken. And what we must infer from that action is this: that the legislature cured a problem that they felt personally when they passed that constitutional amendment. However, what the legislature did in passing that provision and saying that their short-term overlaps were de minimis was to abandon any arguable, colorable state purpose that the state could allege that short-term overlaps should disqualify people running for the legislature. They simply can't have it both ways. They can't say when we, the legislature, are running for the Supreme Court, that short-term overlap is of no moment. It's perfectly all right. In fact, it is part of the public policy that we should be able to run for Attorney General. Once that public policy was abandoned, the underpinnings for any argument that's the same short-term overlap, the days are almost identical, the same short-term overlap should disqualify anyone running for the legislature.
So while they chose to amend one section of the Constitution and not the other, we should just imply that they wanted to cover both of them?
No, Your Honor, they didn't want to cover. I'm not suggesting that they wanted to cover both of them. They were interested only in protecting themselves so that they could have the eligibility to run for office. But in doing what they did, and putting into our Constitution that short-term overlap is de minimis, no moment. In fact, in furtherance of a state policy, it abandoned and completely cut the underpinnings out of any argument that could be made that there is any state interest in maintaining a concept or not having the concept of de minimis applied to persons wanting to run for the legislature.
Doesn't that argument run contrary to the spirit of the writing of Justice Gonzalez for a majority of this court in Sears against Bayou, that application of this de minimis concept to eligibility requirements sacrifices the mandate of the Constitution for political expediency?
First of all, in Sears versus Bayou, the legislature and the people had not adopted a constitutional amendment embodying the concept of amendments. Justice Gonzalez was not faced with any situation that was comparable to this, where had they said, let's assume that it was comparable, let's assume that the legislature had passed and the people had adopted a constitutional amendment saying, well, not with respect to judges of the Supreme Court, but with respect to the Attorney General, that he would only have to be a lawyer for a certain period of time and that short their deviations would be de minimis. I believe in that circumstance, Justice Gonzalez and this court would have been compelled to say, once the people have adopted with respect to a particular type of qualification, and we're talking about the identical type of qualification here. We're not talking about length of term. I mean, we're not talking about how many years you've been a lawyer or how old you are. We're talking about whether or not short-term overlaps make a difference. And the legislature and the people have said they don't make a difference.
Well, of course, the first time that Mr. Wentworth was elected to the legislature, he didn't have a short-term overlap, did he?
That's correct.
In fact, if you look back at the first time that he ran for legislative office, could you explain to the court how his position at that time was any different than that of Patty Lou Dawkins, who stood before this court less than a year ago?
Was any different than Patty Lou Dawkins?
Right.
The first time he was elected?
Right.
I clearly think that the first time he was elected in, I think it was 88, had he been challenged, this court would have declared him ineligible.
Same thing true in the second time he ran?
Certainly the arguments that we're arguing to this court today would not have been applicable at that point.
So if the Republican Party had kept him off the ballot the first time or the second time he ran, you wouldn't have the kind of argument that you have today?
That's correct.
And so should he benefit from the fact that they did not do then what they're doing today and keep him off the ballot?
I don't think he's benefiting by it. The argument that we're advancing today is clearly an argument that is based on the facts of this case, and that the legislature has abandoned any state interest. And the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, specifically held in footnote 3, it says, the dissent illustrates here under the circumstances of this case, the holdings in Lee and Kirk do not effectuate any conceivable purpose behind Article 3, Section 19 of our Constitution. We agree with this analysis. Under the facts of this case, we're not talking about, as they were in Clements v. Fashing, we were talking about a two-year overlap. And in a very narrow opinion, they said because it was the judiciary involved and so forth, this two-year overlap, we think that there is a state purpose behind preventing term jumping of 2 years.
Mr. Yes. Let me interrupt for a moment. In 1964, in Lee versus Daniel, this court held that even after an office holder resigns from office, candidate is not eligible to run with the legislature if the term of the original office overlaps with the legislative term. Would we not have to overrule Lee versus Daniels in order to grant you relief?
You would certainly have to modify the language in Lee versus Daniels to take into account that if this court interprets Article 3, Section 19 to disqualify Wentworth, there is no rational state purpose for that determination anymore. And so, therefore, Lee versus Daniels, which, Your Honor, frankly, I believe should be overruled, Lee versus Daniels would certainly have to be modified with respect to these short-term overlaps that were created by Senate Bill 194, which everyone agrees was not intended to create a mass of ineligible voters.
Counsel. You don't believe that the resignation, Mr. Wentworth's resignation, before he took legislative office the first time he was elected, has any effect on this?
Well, if you...
Fannie Lou Dawkins, as I recall, had not resigned.
That is correct. I believe that there's a significant difference between Patty Lou Dawkins in this case. First of all, Relator not only resigned 4 or 5 years ago, Relator took another incompatible office and constitutionally was divested, in Article 16, Section 40, was constitutionally divested of that prior office. We made this point in our brief that there was no way that Patty Lou Dawkins' case rests on all fours with this case. He was constitutionally divested by Article 16, Section 40 of that prior office by taking the office of state representative. And by the way, I do want to point out, and I know I'm taking up some of my co-counsel's time here, that this provision is interpreted extremely erratically. Those of you who have been in the legislature, and I know some of you have, know that it is routine and is never challenged. A member of the House of Representatives who is holding a lucrative office and is midterm has always been allowed to run for the Senate midterm when a special election comes up. It's done every time. In fact, I suspect that a third of the senators sitting right now are sitting in violation of Article 3, Section 19 because they have always been allowed to run from the House to the Senate. Likewise, this provision, because of Senate Bill 194, is disqualifying numerous people. There is other people on the ballot this time. There are Republicans on the ballot this time that the Republican Party knows about that they have not disqualified, who are in the exact same position as Relator. This provision needs to be interpreted in a basic, fair method. And the people of this state have already spoken. With respect to short-term overlaps, they're de minimis. And there can be no, in a federal court arguing the constitutionality of Article 3, Section 19 as applied to Relator Wentworth, there can be no argument there is any state purpose. That state purpose has clearly been abandoned. And I would like to relinquish the rest of my time to you.
I have one more question before you do sit down, Mr. Wood. Why did the parties in this case stipulate or agree that if this was a lucrative office within the constitutional prohibition, understanding that it's got similar emoluments to the one held by Patty Lou Dawkins, and that was recently
decided. We just stipulated to the fact that he received $35 or $50, I can't remember which dollars, and that has been held by this court in the past to be a lucrative office. That is always stipulated.
Even though under the provisions of the Constitution, Article 3, Section 19, all of the offices enumerated there carry salary with them, and generally speaking, all would be regarded as full-time offices.
I understand that.
When you hold any other lucrative office, if you get anything part, then you're within the prohibition, even if you don't get a salary, even if it's part-time, volunteer,
I would certainly
citizen,
say
soldier type office.
The arguments made in Dawkins' case that these are not the type of offices we were speaking to in the Constitution, I have a lot of sympathy with that. Unfortunately, 5 members of this court didn't agree. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to address just briefly the matter of the fashion case and its effect on this case. It seems to me that if ever there was a case that was sort of foreshadowed by the footnote in fashion that Article 3, Section 19 might not pass constitutional muster as to other offices, this is the case that court must have had in mind. In fashion, the Supreme Court struggled to find a legitimate state purpose or rationale for Section 19 of Article 3, and they found it there in the case of a judicial officer, a JP, running in midterm, by saying, well, the state has an interest in protecting the integrity of the judiciary so that these judges won't be tempted to abuse their judicial office by making political decisions while running for the legislature. And they might have an interest in seeing that judges don't neglect the duties of their judicial office while campaigning for the legislature. and they wanted to encourage judges to serve their full terms. You know, there's a maxim in tort law that you take your victim as you find it. And I submit that the state of Texas takes Jeff Wentworth as it finds him, not as he was 4 years ago, but as he is today. He is a member of the legislature. He has been a member of the legislature for 4 years. Now, how does the rationale that the Supreme Court found in fashion to uphold the constitutionality of Section 19 apply to Jeff Wentworth? First of all, he's not a judicial officer, so that special interest that the United States Supreme Court says the state of Texas has doesn't apply to him. Second, the discouragement doesn't apply to him. We're not going to discourage him from using his executive office.
Mr. Park, your time has expired. Does anybody have a question?
Is your argument basically we should have one rule for judges and another rule for legislators?
No, Your Honor. My argument basically is that the rationale for supporting Section 19 that the United States Supreme Court found in fashion simply has no application to a current member of the legislature who's been there for 4 years and is running to stay in the legislature.
Any other questions? I have one.
Yes.
And perhaps this would have been better directed to your co-counsel, but have you examined the history of how this provision got into the state constitution?
How Section 19 got into it?
Well, but during the term for which he is elected or appointed, that phrase.
I have not. There's a history. It was not at some times, I think, in the Constitution, and then it was.
That's correct. It was not in the predecessor constitutions and was not in the draft recommendation that went to the floor of the convention and was added on the floor. And Texas is the only state that has that language in the prohibition against running for the legislature clause. It does not have it in the member of Congress or person holding an office of trust in the United States. It's Article 16, Section 12. It says they shall not be eligible as a member of the legislature or any other office of trust or property while they're holding the federal office. And then there are two provisions that have the during the term language. And most states have holding under this provision as well. In fact, all the other states do. We're the only state that has during the term engrafted into another state official running for the legislature.
And the section also includes the term while holding another office. So, and
well,
we have no legislative
history. It's always had that, and this was just engrafted into it. Now, in the other states, they just have holding, and there it's clear. Well, the other states are pretty uniform. If you resign, you're no longer holding the office, as it would be for a member of Congress who wanted to resign to take a $600 a month job in the legislature. They can do that. It's also fairly clear that a legislator cannot run for one of these offices where the emoluments have been, the salary or emoluments have been increased, subject to the exceptions that have been engrafted on. I just wonder how you can square the addition, the conscious addition by the framers of the Constitution of this language to make it more like the prohibition against a legislator running for a higher office with an interpretation that would not have that language.
And so far as I'm aware, we have no legislative history to aid us.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Patrick Wiseman will give an argument for the real party in interest, and Mr. Moody Daniel will give an argument for response.
May it please the court. I represent Colonel Higgins in this matter, and I think I first should address a collateral matter, which is that, as this court is aware, SB 1 is currently at least the plan in effect rather than the federally ordered plan. Colonel Higgins resigned his candidacy because he believes it's in the best interest of the people to have a democratically established plan in place. However, he has resigned only conditionally, and should the election actually take place under the court-ordered plan, he would remain a candidate, and therefore he maintains a concrete interest in this matter, such that his position should bear weight to this court.
Is there any There's no doubt that this remains a live case regardless of which plan, because it affects
Representative
Wentworth's eligibility to run in either district.
The only question becomes is whether he's an interested party.
Mr. Higgins.
That is correct. And possibly Representative Wentworth as well, given that...
Well, that was my question.
I'm sorry, you used the term he, and I was thinking of my client. That may well become a factor, depending on how this case turns out.
But this case would also affect Mr. Wentworth's eligibility to be appointed by the Republican Executive Committee as a candidate in some other Senate district, I think.
That is correct. The rationale behind Article 3, Section 19 is the key point here. It's to encourage appointed office holders to serve out their term. It's particularly important in the area of education. In fact, we passed Article 7, Section 16, allowing an extended term for educators just for that purpose. I point that out in the brief. And so what we're talking about here is not a question that is irrational at all. What we're talking about is if people voluntarily accept a position in government, should they be allowed to resign that when they think there is a better office for them to run for? Or should they be encouraged, although we could not compel them directly, should they be encouraged to continue in that office through its termination so that the agencies of the state in particular, runs by its appointed officials, so that those agencies have continuity and that their policies continue on a day-to-day basis in a orderly means, rather than having people come in for 14 months and leave and someone else being appointed. In this case, is a prime example of just what a problem that can create.
Flawing that argument is that you could resign and run for a lot of jobs, just not the legislature.
And that's right. I do not think that the people or the legislature could create an involuntary servitude on the part of a person who can resign and do a number of other things. Run for another state, run for federal government, even take some positions in state government. The legislature, or the people, or nor the people, have a responsibility to solve all the problems at once. They can create encouragements that are totally rational, but at the same time may not be absolutely box canyons to create an absolute result.
Well, what have we done to solve the problem, as you see it, of candidates term jumping or leaving their appointed offices?
Term jumping has two problems.
Since the Constitution was written in 1876, this one step at a time argument has a flaw in it, and that is we've only taken one step since the last time we took a step over a century ago.
And maybe that was enough of a step according to the people, but it is the Constitution. It is our Constitution written and passed by the people. And this court is frankly not in power to decide what is a better constitutional format, unless you can come up with either an interpretation that is consistent with our Constitution or find that it's somehow, our Constitution somehow violates the federal Constitution.
We should interpret the Constitution as a whole, you would agree, as opposed to interpreting this one provision in isolation.
I think the reason the Constitution was written in articles is that they have different purposes. I think the reason there are sections within articles is for the same reason, that each one of these is a discrete concept. Now, I don't think that there is another constitutional provision in the Texas Constitution that can hold this provision unconstitutional, that is, trump this provision. That is, you must presume that each word in the Constitution used by the people was meant to mean something. And I think that is specifically in point on the issue of whether or not what the people did in Article 3, Section 18 somehow affects Article 19. It clearly doesn't. If the people, and counsel for Mr. Wentworth has suggested that this is the legislature, and of course the legislature has a function here, but the legislature cannot amend the Constitution.
How about what the people did in Article 16, Section 40, and which we've interpreted, this court's interpreted several times, to say that the being sworn in to another civil office of emolument
represents a ipso facto resignation. Matter of fact, we've used the term, we said the term of office ends automatically of the prior office. Shouldn't we read that provision in harmony, if we can, with this provision?
I would say that's true. I don't think it affects this case. Number one, if the Dawkins interpretation is correct or stands, then Mr. Wentworth was never entitled to acquire a new office or the new office that he acquired, and therefore he has never effectively resigned in those terms. Secondly,
how would we deal with the fact that he served at least three partial terms, or one full term and two partial terms in the legislature, whereas to say that that was of no effect and his service was somehow void, his votes could not be counted?
No. I think once he's in the legislature and the House has decided he's in the legislature for that term, he's in, and you have no power to. On the other hand, that he has somehow, it happens in the law all the time.
Counsel, if that is the case, if he was, because the House has the authority under the Constitution to determine the qualifications of its members, and they seated him as a member, what about Mr. Wood's argument that effectively, that was totally incompatible with his continuing service or continuing obligation, or in this case, continuing burden of service on the Board of Regents? If he is in the legislature, he cannot also be on the Board of Regents, period. And they said he was in the legislature, and he is in the legislature. This court has no authority to divest him of that position. It's incompatible with the other position, so it's vacated. Now, you're saying that, I assume, but the term of that other office still is in place.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you another question. It's probably a bad analogy, but when it comes to construing tax provisions, we have rules of construction, both statutory and constitutional. When the legislature enacts a tax, or any other political subdivision of the state enacts a tax, the rule of construction generally is that they've got the burden of proof before they can collect that tax. Once they've met that burden of proof and the tax is upheld as being valid, then exemptions to that tax are strictly construed against being exempt, against the person or entity that might be exempt. They have the burden of proof that they are exempt from that valid tax. When it comes to eligibility for public office under the Constitution, following that analogy, it follows, it seems to me, that we should say that when it comes to minimum qualifications, age, education, residency, and what have you, that the rule should be that we strictly construe those provisions against eligibility. You have burden of proving that you're eligible. That's a constitutional requirement. Once you've established your eligibility, then the rule of construction shifts in favor of qualification. In other words, whoever seeks to disqualify you, even the government, has the burden of proving that you are disqualified. And those disqualifications should be strictly construed in favor of eligibility. I still have a great deal of difficulty, as I did in the Dawkins case, in perceiving this as a lucrative office. It carries no salary. It does carry a reimbursement for expenses, the per diem and what have you. It is a part-time office. And the constitutional prohibition addresses, in those enumerated offices, full-time offices, or what are generally full-time offices, all of which carry a salary. I have a hard time saying that this is a lucrative office under that standard. Yet both sides seem to have conceded that this is indeed a lucrative office. We're not bound by that, because if it's not the law, it's not the law.
I'd like to address that very point, Your Honor. I do find Dawkins to be the most troubling issue. The underlying holding of Dawkins is the most troubling issue in this case, and I've given that some thought. And I think the easy...
While you're talking about Dawkins, you might want to follow through and address the question of whether the resignation is effective to do anything or not.
The easy answer, I think, to Dawkins in this case is that the relator made a specific decision not to challenge Dawkins. And I think that a kind of a very lawyerly, technically argument, a technical argument can be made along those lines. I don't think it's necessary here, however. Should the court consider overruling Dawkins here, sui sponte? I think the answer to that is no. And the reason for that is because even though the issue has not been raised, it also is a circumstance that goes to the very heart of this court's authority. This court has authority not through its military might or its legislative powers, but rather its authority stems almost totally from the belief of the people that there is a fair and impartial process going on here. And that very concept and the concept of law requires respect for precedents and the continuity over time for precedents. How can the community respect a rule of law where an unsolicited overruling of a case not 6 months old, the Dawkins case, will result in a Democratic candidate, Patty Lou Dawkins, being denied the opportunity to run for office in this election?
Counsel, I believe she was candidate for Republican primary.
Excuse me.
Has anybody asked to overrule Dawkins versus Meyer?
It has not, been asked in this case, General.
Right.
And it's in fact, the relator has specifically indicated in his brief that he does not ask for that.
And you're certainly not asking him to do it.
He's not asking for such a rule.
And you're not asking him
to do it. No, sir. I do not think that it would be appropriate, and I think it would lead people to believe that the process itself has the appearance of unfairness. And two people whose term expire on the same day, who bring similar claims to court, and one is denied the right to run and the other is allowed.
Counsel, I'd like to refer you to the official interpretive comment. It says Section 19, which we're talking about today, can be traced back to the British Parliament of 1701. The whole purpose, it says, was to prevent the King from having his officers become members of the British Parliament, thus having a merging of the doctrine of separation of state, in other words, having the executive and the legislative combined. Now, if the purpose was to keep the branches of government separate, and Mr. Wentworth has resigned, my question to you is the word term, T-E-R-M, in Section 19, does that mean term until he resigns or term until it expires if the purpose is separation of powers?
I think the whole point of the separation of powers argument is not addressed to the issue of whether the person would retain the office once in the legislature. In fact, what happens in an executive branch position is that you acquire a substantial bureaucratic base, which can be used for good or ill, but one of the things it can be used for is to suggest that if your particular bureaucracy does not achieve its ends in the legislature, that you will use the structure that's there in order to run against an incumbent. I think that's exactly what the Section 19 is designed to prevent. And if you allow people to say, I'm going to resign or I have resigned, but do it particularly where it's a short-term overlap, that you create exactly that sense in the legislature.
Mr. Wiseman, let me be sure I understand. Now, you're saying that the use of the term of office, the phrase term of office in the Constitution, means that when a governor appoints someone to a term of office in these many appointments that she can make, she inflicts upon that person who receives the appointment a mark that they cannot ever get away from during the period that the legislature has established for that term of office. There is no way that a person can resign, move out of the state, or whatever, and remove that handicap from the ability to run for some other office, that they are marked for that particular period of time, regardless of what happens to them. Is that your...
Your Honor, I'm not saying that. This court has said that.
But that's the argument you're making.
I am saying that Levy Davis is a...
Daniel, excuse me, is a
controlling case here, which this court has ruled upon.
And the fact that someone such as Representative Wentworth can be elected three times to other constitutional offices, they still are under that handicap until the length of the term as provided by law, not by the Constitution, by law, has expired.
That is what the Constitution says, Your Honor, according to your interpretation of it, this court's interpretation of it.
Does that mean no federal judge can ever, once you are sworn in as a United States judge, you are never eligible for the legislature of Texas?
I believe that's true.
Unless you're thrown out for misbehavior, I presume, because your term only runs 8 years. Let me ask one more question. I had the opportunity last week to hear Justice Kennedy speak, and he made a statement that the court had been criticized for judicial activism in some respects, starting with Brown versus the Board of Education in particular, because it was a departure, a radical departure, a complete reversal of Plessy versus Ferguson. And you made the public confidence argument, and that it was argued then that confidence in the court and in the judicial process would be shaken if they so soon departed from what they had earlier said the law was. Of course, Plessy versus Ferguson was pretty old at the time that Brown versus Board of Education was concerned. But whether it's Lee or whether it's Dawkins, no matter how old or how fresh the case is, he went on to make another point, and that when he does not believe Brown versus the Board of Education was judicial activism, he does not believe Brown versus the Board of Education was a departure from the law, because he believed firmly in his heart and in his conscience and in his intellect that Plessy versus Ferguson was wrong the day that it was decided. And if Lee and Dawkins are both wrong, why should we not depart from them?
I think there's a couple of answers to that. First, there is, I think, a tremendous difference between using the color of someone's skin to decide whether or not they're going to be entitled to public accommodations, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the 14th Amendment, which specifically addresses the issue.
You think it's any better when someone allows himself to be used by the public, who offers himself for some public service, to be further disqualified from other public service for a fixed period of years?
I think that a public servant takes on a lot of responsibilities. They have to avoid conflicts of interest. They've got to come to work at the...
Here again, the lucrative office thing emerges. It's always there bubbling around. It cannot be ignored. It has to be addressed. I think even though the parties here have de facto stipulated that this is a lucrative office under previous decisions of this court, I think those decisions are wrong. I think this is not a lucrative office. I think this is not within the term prohibited by the Constitution or ever intended to be prohibited by the Constitution.
Justice Kennedy just was one of the three members of the panel that upheld the basic holding in Roe v. Wade. And those three members, Justice Kennedy, Justice O'Connor, and Justice Souter, wrote, I think, a very appealing portion of their brief, and one need not have an opinion on abortion one way or another to find that portion of their opinion appealing. It really talks about exactly that issue of how the court should go about selecting a case that it would overrule and what the process should be. And they rely on Cardoza and a whole series of important cases. Now, you have not been allowed to really consider those issues thoroughly because the relator chose not to challenge Dawkins straight up and up.
But he did choose to challenge the same cases that we were asked to overrule 6 months ago, and Dawkins were asked to be overruled again today, right?
Not
some of the same cases, Lee against Daniels, Pitts case.
I think that is true to an extent, Your Honor. That is, that this court did look at those issues and did decide them once again 6 months ago.
Same cases we reaffirmed 6 months ago and relied on 6 months ago.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, one thing that the opposing counsel does ask is that we examine the meaning of Justice Rehnquist's footnote about judicial offices may be different from other offices and look at federal constitutional challenges on that ground. What did that footnote mean? What did they have in mind?
I think that footnote meant exactly what it said, which was we're not faced with the issue today, and so we do not decide it. I think
but you believe we are. That does leave us free to decide the federal constitutional issue. We're not foreclosed by the Supremacy Clause on the basis of Clemens and Fashion.
You could not decide...
A judge. We couldn't decide JP's the other way, but we're free on this issue.
You are free to the extent that you read Clemens in that manner. However...
Well, do you read it in some other manner?
Yes, sir. I certainly do. And as I cite in my brief, the proper interpretation of that case or any plurality case, according to the Supreme Court, is by referring to the concurring opinion, in this case, Justice Stevens' opinion. Now, Justice Stevens is going to be in any group of justices on the Supreme Court who are most likely to find a constitutional infirmity in a statute such as this. And he found no problem whatsoever, not on the highly technical issues of whether it was a judge or something else, but rather on the basis that there was no federal constitutional concerns implicated by this type of constitutional provision of the state constitution. And he was very clear on it. And just...
But wouldn't the four votes led by Judge Rehnquist added to the four votes led by Justice Brennan add up to more than Justice Stevens on this question of this
that
being
is true.
An open issue?
As I said in the brief, and I cite the cases, the proper way to interpret it is through Justice Stevens' opinion, they would take stare decisis as an important consideration in this regard. And finally, if we're going to count votes, the four votes that were in dissent are largely no longer there. Depending on how we count our fingers, we can look at it a lot of different ways. I would agree that Justice Rehnquist does put in some limiting language as to how broadly they were considering the issues. I would not agree that one can make a principal distinction between the justice of the peace and an appointee to a statewide board.
You do not agree with Justice Rehnquist's arguments that judges are different. He makes a fairly eloquent argument that judges are different from other elected officials, and you discount that and believe we should as well.
I think judges are, and I think that's what he was faced with in that case, and he did what the Supreme Court ought to do, which is decide on fairly narrow grounds. But I would argue there is not a principal distinction. If what you're looking at is the function of keeping, as the interpretive comment says under Section 19, if you are looking at the function of keeping particularly the executive branch, not the judicial, because the executive branch is the one that has the significant bureaucratic power that can affect legislative votes.
By way of simple common sense, does it not disturb you that the United States Constitution would reach a different result and that the constitutions of every other state in our country would reach a contrary to the result to what you're proposing today?
Not at all. It was exactly what this country was founded upon, which was a central government, but then independent states. We do not call our states provinces or regions. We call them states because they contain their own constitution, and each state is a laboratory in which different mechanisms can be explored. And short of some violation of the federal constitution, the people of this state have the right to exercise those laboratory experiments, if you will, and do something different than the other 49 states. That's exactly what our constitution is meant to allow us to do.
I do remain troubled by the equal protection argument. Can you just tell us, short of Boat County why it is that Mr. Wentworth and people similarly situated have not been denied equal protection, because there's a strong argument that perhaps I've been.
What we're talking about here is not either a permanent disqualification or a disqualification that one is forced to accept. Every day we create classes of people who can do one thing but not another. We do that in all kinds of circumstances. If I am a lawyer representing a client, I can't be the judge of that case. If I am in any number of positions, I could not, when I was with the Attorney General's office, I could not engage in some business that would conflict with my responsibilities as an Attorney General. Those are all limits on all of us. And government must have the power to do that. I would agree with you that at every, on every limit, that at the margins, it appears arbitrary. I'm not sure that this is at the margins, but I would agree that at the margins, every limit seems arbitrary. But if, particularly in these kinds of situations where people need to know before they run for office what the requirements are, if we create a situation where we allow all kinds of extraneous issues to come in and people then don't know by clear lines when they can run and when they can't, then we do more harm to the system than we do by having what at the margins is an arbitrary limit. And that is not an equal protection violation. And that's basically the position that Justice Stevens takes. And I think it is the position that the Chief Justice would take as well if faced with this kind of issue.
Any other questions? Your time has expired. But I think that was due to our questions, I believe. Mr. Daniel has a short argument.
Yes.
We should permit it.
Thank you, Your Honor. In large measure, really want to inform the court that Chairman Meyer has scheduled a meeting of the District Committee for this Saturday, the 22nd. Obviously, scheduled the committee meeting after this oral argument in order to enable the court to direct us whether or not we need to conduct that meeting. Now,
what is the last possible day that the party could act to name a different nominee if need be as a result of a decision we make?
It is September 7th, but the party under the election code is given the opportunity not only to seek the advice of and decision of the district committee, but if that's unsuccessful, to also go to the state Republican Executive Committee in order to come up with a candidate. And that's why Chairman Meyer felt that there was no practical way to delay beyond this Saturday going ahead and conducting the district meeting. On the practical side of relief, we also wanted to point out that Chairman Meyer has declared Representative Wentworth ineligible and has transmitted that declaration of ineligibility to the Secretary of State. So if the court grants relief, certainly the Republican Party is not going to conduct any meetings with respect to the eligibility for this office, but that doesn't necessarily get Representative Wentworth on the ballot, and really the Republican Party wants a qualified candidate on the ballot for that particular district, and we do believe that the Secretary of State needs to be directed to put Representative Wentworth on the ballot beyond just telling Chairman Meyer that his ineligibility ruling was incorrect. And then finally, I think the questions from the panel have indicated the position that Chairman Meyer was placed in. Certainly Chairman Meyer, as would anyone else in his party, would desire that the choice of the majority of the voters, the party's voters in that district, be the candidate for the general election. But when the issue of Mr. Wentworth's service in a state office was presented to Chairman Meyer, Chairman Meyer felt that he had no choice but to follow the law as existed when that issue was presented to him, and to declare Representative Wentworth ineligible under the law as it currently existed. To address your point, Chief Justice Phillips, Clemens v. Fashion may leave some room for a different ruling on the constitutionality of Article 3, Section 19 as applied to a state office holder as opposed to a judge. But Chairman Meyer is not given the discretion within the election code to make those kinds of decisions. Chairman Meyer is obligated under the decision in Sears v. Bayoud to apply the law of Texas as he finds it, apply Article 3, Section 19, as he found it under the authoritative decisions of this court, and that's what Chairman Meyer did, regretfully so.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Daniel, I have a question that does not affect this case, but I'm just curious about it. Mr. Wood made the statement that there are other candidates on the ballot in the Republican ballot with identical problems that Mr. Whitworth is facing here, but Chairman Meyer chose not to contest the eligibility of those candidates, but only Mr. Whitworth. Is that correct?
That is not correct. Chairman Meyer, nor are we aware of any of those situations. And Chairman Meyer has not created any kind of roving commission to go out and find out if there are any of those kinds of situations. When those issues are presented, in other words, the decision on the election code is made on the basis of the public records. And if someone presents to Chairman Meyer the public record, Chairman Meyer then is obligated in those circumstances to determine whether that public record conclusively establishes the ineligibility of a candidate. That's what happened in the Dawkins case. That's what happened in this case. Those are the only two cases that the chairman and we are currently aware of that are out there.
As one who's expressed concern about delay in this court before, I would certainly not want to see any delay interfere with your ability to have the candidate of your choice on the ballot and let people make the decision. But I'm not clear why it is that we have to make that decision by Saturday.
I'm not arguing that you have to make that decision by Saturday. What I'm telling you is that we do have the district committee meeting scheduled so that we can also go on to the state Republican Executive Committee if we need to. If we don't have a decision, then there's no mandamus operating that the chairman would feel obligated not to have the committee meeting this Saturday, but that would not affect the ability of this court to rule later than that.
What circumstance would require you to go beyond the district committee? Perhaps I'm not understanding fully the procedure. Is the district committee...
I'm not sure I can explain it to you.
You're saying that the district committee's decision would not in all things be final?
There,
the
as I understand
it, on September the 7th or September the 6th.
Obviously, we also have the complication of what the federal court down the street is,
sure,
is also going to do. It's my understanding that under the Terrazas plan instituted for the primary, that this district goes into three counties so that there will be three counties represented on the district meeting if the Terrazas plan is in effect. If Senate Bill 1 is in effect, I think this district lies wholly within Bexar County so that you would not have multiple counties represented on that district committee, so that there may not be any problem if it's under Senate Bill 1, whereas you might have the three county members not agree, and in that circumstance you need to go on to the state Republican Executive Committee to get your candidate. I think it is the circumstance of having more than one county in the district. That circumstance arises only so long as the Terrazas plan is in effect, but given all of those uncertainties, the chairman didn't feel like he had any choice but to go ahead and schedule the meeting for this Saturday.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
May it please the court, I'd like to respond, at least in some extent, to some of the questions that were asked to the opposing counsel. And I believe from the case opinions that I've read both of the Court of Appeals in this case, of this court, and recent decisions concerning Article 3, Section 19, that there is a general feeling that this provision operates unfairly, and it operates in a fashion to deny the people the right to vote for very qualified candidates at a time when the people are looking for competition in political office. In other words, this provision, as it has been interpreted, is being interpreted in direct contravention of the public policy that ought to be exercised by this state. And we are, as Chief Justice pointed out, the only state to interpret this, a constitutional provision.
I didn't say that. I said we're the only state that has this language.
Well, I understand it's the only state that has this language. And really, but be that as it may, in response to your question, Chief Justice Phillips, I believe Article 3, Section 18 and Article 3, Section 19 are tied together. And I think they are inextricably tied together. They can serve no other purpose, but the same purpose that is being served by Article 3, Section 19, 18 is the same purpose as being supposedly being served by Article 3, Section 18. Those provisions both use the term, as you pointed out, for the term for which they are elected. There are no, facially, there are really no differences in those provisions, except one thing. One of them is legislators running for other offices. 19 is people wanting to run for the legislature. And that difference is no difference. There's no underlying state interest to say as to why legislators running for other offices should be treated different than people that want to run for the legislature. They are inextricably tied together. Now, in Fashing versus Clements, the only reason the Supreme Court of the United States upheld on a plurality opinion Article 3, Section 19 was because it discerned a legitimate state interest for preventing, in that case, a judicial office from jumping midterm, 2 years into their term. I have personally a very difficult time believing that the Supreme Court of the United States would have affirmed the application of Article 3, Section 19 applied to these facts, because they would have been faced with what you're faced with here, and that is a legislature that had gone and protected itself by passing and sending to the people a constitutional amendment that says our short-term overlaps don't count. In fact, it's good for the state for us to be able to run for office with short-term overlaps. And the next constitutional provision over with almost identical language, then being interpreted that short-term overlaps disqualifies everyone else from running for the legislature. I do not more believe that that Supreme Court or this Supreme, the United States Supreme Court, would agree that equal protection is being met in this particular situation.
Wasn't that issue raised in Dawkins as well as here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Wasn't that issue raised by the briefs in Dawkins?
I don't believe that it was raised, possibly on motion for rehearing, but I don't believe this issue was raised. No, the issue of de minimis as related to Article 3, Section 18 and Article 3, Section 19 was not raised in Dawkins. I could stand to be corrected, but I don't believe so.
If we were to do as you say that we ought to do, and that is declare Mr. Whitworth eligible on the law as it exists now, how do we keep credibility with the Pettigrew documents of the world, the Lee versus Potts and others who have relied on those cases, by reaching a contrary result today that we chose not to do in April or 1964?
Your Honor, I do not know why the litigants in Pettigrew Dawkins did not raise this issue, but it wasn't raised. And the juxtaposition of the legislature declaring their terms, short-term overlap being de minimis, versus this short-term overlap being declared de minimis, was not raised in Dawkins. It's not mentioned. And why they did not raise it, they only know, but it is. Nonetheless, I do not believe this court should adhere to and declare Relator Wentworth ineligible simply because somebody else failed to raise a point that is now being raised here.
Well, the issue in Wentworth was very alive in Lee versus Daniels. Now, Lee versus Daniels was reaffirmed by this court as late as April of this year.
But I know of no case that stand on the facts of this case. We have a situation here where we have the legislature amending a statute, changing terms by some 20 days, And now this court is being asked to say that cannot be considered amendments when the adjoining section, the legislature has declared that their short-term interest, short-term overlaps are diminished. They have repudiated any state interest, as the Court of Appeals said in San Antonio, they have repudiated any legitimate state interest insofar as maintaining that these short-term overlaps have a legitimate state purpose.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments this morning. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of